Hi, I'm Janie Reisner, and welcome to Women's Voices. Listening to Ocarina Chant from my CD, Voice of the Mother. 'Twill be nights before Christmas, and high overhead, the moon will turn orange, or maybe bright red. The earth and the sun with celestial scripts will conspire to make a lunar eclipse. On this very night, total eclipse begins at, I have here 11:41, but be sure to check that for yourself, Pacific time. Interestingly enough, this total lunar eclipse is coinciding with the winter solstice. The following is by Jacqueline Lassan, intuitive astrologer, from her Astro Flash. Wheels of season turn toward winter. Into the dark night, the moon-eclipsed perspective shifts. A primordial score activates an instinctive riff. Turn off the noise and listen. Listen to your breath. Listen to the pulse of your blood. Listen to the planet's design. Their dance entwined, past and future, inner and outer cosmos align. We can gaze within the rising tide of darkness and see the glimmer of stardust in our bones. The constellation of our times draws us nearer, closer to our collective underworld, where truth, morality, and ethics cry out from the center of our galaxy. We are called to face the politics of our own beliefs and transform the judgments that squelch the fire of wisdom and understanding. We cannot rationalize this away, the passions of anger, righteousness, grief and desire must be reckoned in the equation. Crisis motivates change. let go, and move on. The lunar cycle and the seasonal cycle concur. This is the time of inward renewal, to rekindle the flame within. We now plant our seeds into winter's fertile dreaming. Jacqueline says about this very night, we see past and present in a new shape, a sign of endings, radical change. Within hours, the sun enters Capricorn, which signals the solstice. Clearly, this eclipse gives us a strong push to complete unresolved relationship issues.
We are walking in a circle. We are walking hand in hand. We are walking in a circle to create the promised land. We are loving one another. We are crossing the divide. We are walking with our mother and our sisters by our side.
This is music from Genevieve Vaughn's Songs for the Tree of Life. And a note from Gloria Felt. As the moon reemerges to light the winter sky, may your life sparkle, your holidays glitter, and your new year be radiant with the most auspicious of possibilities. So clearly this is an auspicious time, and it seems utterly fitting that my guest this evening is Barbara G. Walker, whose life work has been focused on exposing the heist that has been pulled on humanity, stealing our birthright of peace and love and creativity by the forces that rule, who in their idiocy substitute money for such an extraordinary world of love and kindness. Esteemed elder, scholar, and feminist author Barbara G. Walker's newest book is Man Made God, which expresses her deepest insights on the nature and history of religion, formed over a period of many decades, as Barbara Walker is now 80 years old. Beginning with a degree in journalism from the University of Pennsylvania, Barbara's career has seen her named Humanist Heroine by the American Humanist Association, and receiving the Women Making Her Story award by New Jersey Now. Barbara's work about women include the Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets, The Crone, Women of Age, Wisdom, and Power, Women's Ritual, a source book, and Restoring the Goddess, Equal Rights for Modern Women. She has designed and painted her own tarot and I Ching decks, reinterpreted fairy tales in her popular feminist fairy tales, and authored several volumes of comprehensive knitting references, which have become landmarks for their comprehensiveness and clarity. She is a former student and teacher of the Martha Graham Technique of Dance, and at this time in her life goes bike riding daily to maintain health and fitness. This is from reviews of her book. Barbara Walker stands out as a leading light, not only in the world of women's spirituality and lost mythological traditions, but also in the world of free thought. Barbara's clean and clear take on reality via religious beliefs and ideas dating back many thousands of years to the present is refreshing. Man-made God is powerfully helpful in understanding how human behavior fundamentally transitions from a mother-child-focused culture based on cooperation and kindness to a male-focused culture based on competition and fear. It sheds light on how male-dominated culture encourages abuse, violence, war, and ultimately epic human suffering. Thankfully now, with anthropological and archaeological advances, evidence of our human saga is being resurrected from the womb, once again reminding us that our ancestors weren't always barbaric rivals obsessed with sexual dominance and conquering each other. We're rediscovering we were long ago harmonious cultures of enlightened people, well aware of our natural surroundings. Cultures that lived harmoniously for many thousands of years with each other, where the wisdom of the mother and grandmother was honored. A time arrived when these cultures became systematically usurped to serve conquering rulers and their co-conspiring religious elite. Still today, our leaders are using the same genocidal methods of engineering ignorance to eliminate their competition, systemic persuasion to control the mind, and physical force to instill fear against rebellion. I would like to think we've left behind the Dark Ages with our 21st century progressive attitude toward women and our relative freedom of expression, but these essays expose a sobering reminder of just how stuck in its shadow we still are. Competition and fear enshrined into modern Western thinking is still being bred into our youth as virtue. It's clear today's society still serves the desires of the few at the expense of the many. Welcome, Barbara.
Well, thank you, Jane. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for staying up for our interview, and I'm honored to have you as my guest once again. We've done this a few times before, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
I have to say that it was your book, The Crone, that made its way into my hands, I know not how, when I lived in isolation in the San Geronimo Valley. Deep into my own journey, flooded with realizations, writing and singing and recording, and sending it all out in the daily mail, when your book came along, I looked at it, I dove in here and there, reading bits and pieces, and eventually came to the realization that what I was saying and singing about had a worldly reality to it. Your book substantiated my journey, which up to then I had no point of reference other than my own deep knowing. So, isn't that amazing?
Well, my husband tells me that I've been waiting all my life to be a crone, and so I finally made it.
You surely have.
The word crone actually was related to the word crown, and it used to mean a female tribal leader. And, of course, it became a pejorative word when the patriarchal society took over. Similarly, the word hag also is from the Greek, hagia, meaning a holy woman. And these terms used to mean something much different from what they're saying today. I think, however, that you're quite right about the changing of societies. In my book, Man-Made God, I give the characteristics of the so-called matrist societies as opposed to patrist. And this is what they're like. The pre-patriarchal or matrist cultures were very indulgent toward women, toward children, giving them much more physical affection and little punishment. They tended also to be permissive in various forms of pleasure and sexuality. There were no taboos against homosexuality, no concubinage, no prostitution. Women would control their own fertility and their choice of mates. The sexes would have equal social status, although the family was usually matrilocal and matrilineal. That is, married people would live in the wife's home and the property belonged to her. And the descent was reckoned primarily through mothers, which means blood relationships meant, literally, a woman made her children out of her own blood, which is the blood retained in the womb while the child is being formed. And this, of course, was before they recognized biological fatherhood and thought that women only had this power to create life. There was a democratic division of labor, no caste system, no full-time military. And the religion of these cultures was some variant of nature worship without strict codes. A mother goddess was primary and her consorts were secondary. Sexuality and love between the sexes might have been considered part of religious feeling. Such cultures were generally nonviolent and valued spontaneity, humor, and sensual enjoyments. Then we have, by contrast, the characteristics of the fully developed patric society, which are given as follows. Children are severely treated with harsh physical punishments, restriction of movement, and painful initiations, including genital mutilation. Sexual attitudes were highly restrictive, ascetic, and fearful. Women's freedoms are limited and their status inferior. Marriages were usually arranged by others, and they were patrilocal and patrilineal. They frequently implied sexual and reproductive slavery for wives and or concubines. Heavy taboos surround menstruation, childbirth, abortion, birth control, widowhood, and women's access to the spiritual. There are full-time male clergies and military organizations, and a monotheistic father god who is often depicted as rigidly authoritarian, demanding, and cruel. Pain-seeking asceticism, like, you know, people flogging themselves, and renunciation of sexuality tended to please this god. The men own property, they own women, and they own children, and they may regard war as their most honorable calling. Slavery and torture were permitted and freely discussed, and physical pleasures and sensuality, contrarywise, are viewed with puritanical anxiety and many verbal taboos. Now, we can see these contrasts in our own culture.
Yes, we can.
I used to think that sexism is just a warped sort of social phenomenon, but I realized somewhere along the line in my studies that it's actually rooted in religion.
Yes, and hang on one second. I want to say you're listening to KZYX. This is Women's Voices. I'm Janie Reisner. I'm here with Barbara G. Walker talking about her newest book, Man-Made God. Please continue.
Well, Dr. James DeMeo has written about these early institutions, and he says that these institutions, which nurtured children emotionally and venerated heterosexual love and allowed much freedom in sexual matters, once persisted across all of Europe, Asia, Africa, and India. In all cases, the arrival of militant, armored, nomad groups from Central Asia and Arabia initiated cultural transitions, which destroyed the male-female and maternal-infant bond and placed all family matters, including the choice of marriage partners, in the hands of dominant males. Now, we have the Old Testament, which shows us that marriages were very much dominated by men in Old Testament times. It says in the Bible that a woman may not divorce her husband, but he may divorce her, which is the system followed today under Islam. All he has to do is give her a bill of divorcement and turn her out of the house. And, of course, the Muslims are doing this today. In the early Christian fathers, they had such a terrible fear of female sexuality and conviction of the sinfulness of women that their writings reflect this all over the place. St. Thomas Aquinas, the so-called angelic doctor, ruled that a wife may be freely used and abused because she is lower than a slave. God says she is in subjection to her husband. That's God's law. In the 15th century, an ecclesiastical rules of marriage recommended scolding and bullying of a wife by her husband, which could actually earn him credit in heaven. Beating his wife out of concern for her soul, I quote that, is a good thing to do.
Yeah.
Martin Luther thought himself an unusually kind husband because he didn't beat his wife with a whip or a stick, but occasionally he punched her in the head when she got saucy, as he wrote. Luther noted that girls mature a lot faster than boys for the reason that, and I quote, weeds grow faster than good crops.
Yeah.
And some fathers of the church maintained that women are born imperfect, birth-defected males only because their fathers, at the time they were conceived, were either ill or in a state of sin.
Gosh. Excuse me, but are you reading from your book?
In part, yes.
Are you in the violence in religion? Is this the part that you're in right now?
This is under sexism.
Uh-huh. Okay. Go ahead.
John Scotus Erigena said that when the heavens finally open in glory, women will be no more because God has embodied the sinless part of humanity in man and the sinful part in woman. Clement of Alexandria wrote that Christ's mission on earth was to destroy the works of the female and that every woman should be permanently ashamed of her gender. Saint Odo of Cluny said woman is a sack of dung. And Bishop John Aylmer in the 16th century described woman as the dregs of the devil's dung hill.
I don't think they liked us very much. You don't hear anybody, of course, reading any of this stuff. Has it been disowned? Does anybody in the religious order say this is obscene and shouldn't be allowed? Or?
I'm sure that they have been trying to forget about it. But nevertheless, this is embodied in Judeo-Christian religion. The very fact that we have a male God, an exclusively male God,
yeah.
Some churchmen today say that God could not possibly have a physical body, in which case God could not possibly have gender, because in order to have gender, you have to have genitals of one kind or another and hormones of one kind or another. And therefore, this God that they seem to be worshiping today can't be a he or a she, but an it. If it has no physical body, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, they keep on referring to God as he.
Right.
And the women's groups who refer to the goddess are not thinking that literally. They are not calling the goddess a literal being somewhere out there in space. On the contrary, the goddess is a concept which has to do with, you know, Mother Earth, Mother Nature, the life force that yes. women foster in the world. And therefore, I think that concept is a great deal more naturalistic and of course, green. And
yes.
I think that this is what we need in this world. We need to stop thinking of man as the model of God. Now, when the Second Vatican Council met, the women attending were addressed as follows. This is a quote. Women of the entire universe, you to whom life is entrusted, it is for you to save the peace of the world, end quote. But women were not allowed to speak at this event, especially on the subject of saving the world. And the few women who were admitted as observers freely mingled with the delegates on the first day, and later they were relegated to a coffee room.
Yeah.
So not even on the coffee breaks could their presence contaminate the purity of the decision-making process.
Now tell me again where this was and when.
Second Vatican Council.
Uh-huh, and when did that occur?
That was just about 10, 15 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Mary Condren wrote recently, and I quote, "The subjugation of women formed the central ideology of Western Christianity." And Annie Laurie Gaylor says, quote, "Repudiation of patriarchal religion is an essential step in freeing women."
Yeah.
And, of course, good old Elizabeth Cady Stanton in the 19th century wrote that the church has done more to degrade women than all other adverse influences put together. And I think she was absolutely right about that.
The highest, the deepest, the most powerful power is spiritual power. This is what God decrees, you know, that's the final word.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rosemary Radford Ruther, who is a modern theologian, says that because women are not in fact inferior, but full human persons, upon whom all males as children are once dependent, the task of suppressing women into dependence on males is a never-ending struggle, which of course goes on today. It must be reiterated generation after generation by repeating the myths of women's original sin to the young, both male and female, and by reinforcing laws and structures that marginalize women from power roles in society. And religion is relied upon as both the foundation and the daily aid in this project.
Mm-hmm.
So I think modern churches are still ignoring the knowledge that scholars have revealed that the primary deity of the human species was not a he, but a she.
That's absolutely right.
Theological imagery needs to return to that as a biological fact. And, of course, they're doing their best to ignore that because they don't want to destroy the image of the patriarchal God.
Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times, I'm sure you, too, read an article or hear something about someone going on about our violent past, you know, war has always been part of it, completely ignoring our ancient past.
Mm-hmm.
When you were speaking of the Garden of Eden,
mm-hmm,
in your book and how wonderful that place was, could you talk about that?
Yes, well, of course, the figure of Eve in the Garden of Eden was an adaptation of a very, very old goddess image throughout the Near East. She was referred to as Hiva or Hewa or Heya, all kinds of variations on the name. And even in Sanskrit, there is an Eva. And it seems that Eve was originally the mother and producer of Adam. There was a conception charm much used among women in the Middle East. They would make a little clay image of a baby and anoint it with menstrual blood, which is the magic blood that gives life, and they would use that as a sympathetic charm to produce a child. They thought that, you know, sympathetic magic simply means that you imitate the desired result. If you're worried about the sun being reborn after the winter solstice, you make fires, you light candles, you have lights that make sunlight lengthen. If you want rain, you pour water, and this encourages rain to come. If you want a baby, you make a baby image, and you anoint it with the blood of life. So, God's creation of living creatures out of clay was, of course, copied from that era. And the idea of making the first woman out of Adam's rib actually comes from early Mesopotamian myths, where the goddess of childbirth was named Lady of the Rib, from a belief that mothers made all their children's bones out of one of their own ribs in utero. So the rib was another magical part of birth giving. Eve was known as the Divine Lady in early Mesopotamian literature. In northern Babylonia, she was the goddess of the Tree of Life, And her biblical title, Mother of All Living, was a common Middle Eastern name for the goddess herself. The Paradise Garden was called Hayden in the sacred literature of Persia, which predated the Bible. Nineva was the Holy Lady Eve. That was her magic, her city. And interestingly, the name Eve in Hebrew is He Vav He, which is H-W-H in Latin letters, in Hebrew letters. In Latin letters, it's E-V-E, which is a word of several meanings, including life or woman or a matrilineal blood kinship group, and the wisdom of the serpent. Now, that dread, unpronounceable name of God, the taboo tetragrammaton that no man but a high priest could speak, was exactly the same as the name of Eve, He, Va, He. And with the addition of Yod in the beginning, in Latin letters, that's I-Eve, I-E-V-E. Isn't that interesting? It was transcribed into Yahweh or Jehovah, but originally the word is I-Eve. All kinds of cute little things like that turn up when you when you study the literature.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also talked about how this, in the current stories, it's when absolutely she was made, woman was made out of Adam's rib, she was subservient, and of course she was the source of all evil because she tempted him to eat the apple.
Mm-hmm. Well, the apple was another peculiarity because the Bible doesn't say it was an apple. All it says is a fruit. Now, why did we decide that it was an apple? Well, basically, because the apple in the northern countries where apples did grow, the apple was sacred to the goddess, and the dead were buried with apples in their grave to help them come to a new life, help them get reborn. The gypsies had a charm involving apples. If you take any apple and you cut it transversely, mm-hmm. crosswise,
yeah.
what do you see in the core?
Mm-hmm.
You see a pentacle. Mm-hmm. And that was, of course, the star of life, which was very much used by pagan groups and is still today used by pagan groups.
Mm-hmm.
So the apple, the life symbol is in the middle of that fruit,
yes.
which is why it was considered the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. According to the Babylonian literature, the reason the gods wanted to keep the first people ignorant of the knowledge of good and evil was because they wanted to keep them as slaves, to take care of their garden and to plant their food and to give them offerings on the altars. And they did not want them to learn anything that would cause them to do anything else. So they were very angry when these first humans got the knowledge. But of course, it's strange because churches always are purporting to give us the knowledge of good and evil, which is supposedly the taboo knowledge. Isn't that interesting?
Hmm. Something that's interesting to me is how these same images of mother and child, Isis and Osiris, why do they keep reappearing? That's what's interesting to me.
Well, the early Christian fathers were very much opposed to goddess images, which were everywhere. They were all over Europe. Isis nursing her child Horus was very much pictured in Roman culture. There were lots of temples showing a goddess and a baby, and they simply transformed them all into Mary and the child. They said all these pagan goddesses are really Mary, and all these pagan religions were just previews of Christianity invented by the devil to confuse people.
Yeah, I see. If you just look at the images without a story around them, we are seeing the basic forms of all life. we are either a mother or a child. We're all a child, of course, but that's the basic form of life.
Of course, and the fact is that they could not, they tried very hard, but they could not get rid of the mother image in Christianity. So what they did was they tried to minimize it. In the first place, they said that Mary was not a goddess, not divine, just an ordinary person who happened to have been impregnated by a god, in imitation of at least 18 other savior figures who were born of virgins impregnated by gods. And then they said that Mary had no divine nature. Well, people didn't like that. They liked their mother goddess. They insisted on having Mary somewhere in their pantheon. And they insisted on Mary's miracles. In fact, more miracles have been attributed to Mary in Christian history than to Jesus or any angel or any saint. Mary is usually the one that the Madonna is the one that does everything, according to their own traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when Mary was found out to be so popular, they couldn't seem to get rid of her. They tried very hard to humanize her, but they couldn't. So they had to devise a way to make her a little more than human. And what they came up with was to make her somehow more than a saint. So their idea was, well, maybe we'll make Mary ever living, and take her into heaven as a whole person. Her whole body, her whole physical being, will transform into heaven. So the idea was that she would be assumed in her earthly shape into heaven. Now, if a human body can travel at the speed of light, which is impossible in the first place, Mary's physical body would have had to start traveling somewhere around 2,000 years ago, and she would be traveling through space at the speed of light.
To
in
who
2,000
knows where.
Years,
right.
She would have gone only halfway across her own home galaxy, which is 100,000 years in diameter, light years in diameter. So where is she by now? This is something that we worry about.
Yeah, right. Shall we give the website for your for Stellar Books Publishing for people to get more information on your book?
Oh, sure.
Okay, that's www.stellar, STELLAR, bookspublishing.com. And certainly you can order this book, please do, at your local bookstore.
Or from Amazon. Or
I was trying to discourage Amazon. We're discouraging Amazon these days.
Are you?
Well, they're cutting off Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, any information from WikiLeaks.
I was going to go on and say about Mary that when they wanted to make her better than human, they invented the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. And a lot of people think this is the same thing as a virgin birth. But the Immaculate Conception is not the virgin birth. It means the conception of Mary herself. She was conceived without original sin, and all other human beings are conceived with original sin. So Mary was immaculately conceived, and they argued about this idea for 700 years and did not know whether they wanted to make that part of their theology or not. But finally, in the year 1854, Pope Pius IX officially pronounced it an article of faith. So from that time on, every Catholic is commanded to believe that Mary, and I quote, at the first instant of her conception, was preserved immaculate from all stain of original sin. So there you are. This is modern theology. This is part of the canon that is recognized today. The Immaculate Conception, I mean, we have churches of the Immaculate Conception, we have schools of the Immaculate Conception, and most people still think that it simply refers to the conception of Jesus. It's very strange that they really don't explain this very well.
Well, it defies understanding.
Well, of course it does.
Really?
But that's, we're not talking understanding. I mean, this is religion. You don't understand.
That's right.
You are told that it's a mystery. And if you try, when I was in Sunday school as a kid, I was asked, I asked a lot of questions, and I was basically told to sit down and shut up because I don't ask questions about these things. So, of course, I've spent the rest of my life asking questions. That was my training.
Yes, indeed, it was. Well, the desire to question was certainly there. And I think we've talked about this before. Is, you know, as a child, also your sense of morality is very strong.
Yes, indeed. And I think you get a lot of that from books that you read in childhood. And I was a great reader. My parents owned many, many books, and we had a full library, the complete works of Mark Twain, Charles Dickens, you know, the encyclopedias. As a child, I read constantly. Now, this was back in the 1930s, mind you. There was no television. There were no video games. There were no iPods. There were no cell phones. Kids went for indoor entertainment. We read.
Mm-hmm.
We read books.
That's
that
right.
was our enjoyment.
That's right.
And so we learned a lot that way. And I developed a lifelong love of books and reading and taking notes and finding things out. Books are wonderful. They can teach you so much.
Yes, it's so true. And you were an only child.
Yeah.
So you didn't have someone to play with either.
Well, I had neighbor kids. We played outdoors all the time, too, which modern kids don't do a lot of, I hear.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's what I observe. How fortunate you were to have all those books around you that you could dip into, reading probably far beyond your age, all of those things, you know, they were just there.
Well, my parents were great readers, and they taught me by example to enjoy books.
Mm-hmm. Your book is made up of essays, your newest book.
Right.
And these essays have been talks that you've delivered.
Yes, most of them have been sermons that I gave to the Unitarian Universalist Church and in other places around the country. And some of them were based on information that I got for the Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets or the Women's Dictionary of Symbols and Sacred Objects, which is the companion volume to that.
Mm-hmm.
And all that research went on for about 25, 30 years. I started that fresh out of college.
Wow.
I was amazed when I was in college, and I took two courses in medieval history, and I found that the Christian Church had forbidden speaking of the Inquisition in these history courses. And this was a liberal arts Ivy League college, mind you.
Hmm.
And I wondered why, and then I found out later after I graduated and started reading, I found out how horrible this incident, these 500 years in our history, really were.
Hmm.
I read Henry Charles Lee's absolutely classic study, for example, of the Inquisition, and many other books, and found out that this history is what we are losing. And Lee, who did the research in the Vatican Library from original documents, said, this was around the turn of the 1900s, he said at that time, the church authorities were already beginning to destroy the records.
Huh.
So, you know, say they're hoping that this whole thing will be forgotten forever at some point. And now they're claiming that the victims were only, say, a few hundred thousand.
Huh.
but the original documents indicated many millions. After all, it went on for 500 years, and they killed so many women that in some of the European villages there were no more women left alive in the village, or maybe just one or two.
I know.
They were all witches, and they were all burned. And atrocities against women are going on today in Islam to a terrible degree. And there have been many books written on this subject. One of the best that I read recently is Noni Darwish's book called Cruel and Unusual Punishment, where she talks about Sharia law and what it says about the rules about women, which is really pretty horrifying.
Wow. Is this a culture that they stone women?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's one book that really should be read by one and all. Another is Half the Sky by Nicholas Kristof.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Brigitte Gabriel's books, of course, and Infidel by Ayaan Hirsi Ali. There's been a lot of literature, but they're still trying to say that, you know, Islam is a religion of peace and women are not really abused, but unfortunately they are.
Yeah.
And the moderate Muslims are not doing much about it. They're not protesting.
Uh-huh. Hang on one second. This is KZYX. You're listening to Women's Voices. You're listening to Barbara G. Walker and speaking about her newest book, Man Made God. I invite you to call in. The telephone number here is 707. It's good to hear about those books. Do you mind repeating just the titles again, please?
Okay. Cruel and Unusual Punishment by Noni Darwish, Half the Sky by Nicholas Kristof, and Infidel by Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and also Because They Hate by Brigitte Gabriel. All of these are useful information about modern Islam.
Mm-hmm. And who is the man that you spoke of who did the writing about the Inquisition in the 1900s? What was his name?
Henry Charles Lee. He wrote the definitive history of the Inquisition of the Middle Ages. And if anybody wants to know about the Inquisition in detail, that's the book they have to go to.
Uh-huh.
It's a very large, very thick book, but it's full of real information.
I wonder if libraries still carry it, or can, probably.
Well, you can always get a book through interlibrary loan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is one of the greatest organizations in the world. If it were not for interlibrary loan, I would not have been able to do that much research. However, I think that women and religion today, women are supporting patriarchal religions all over the country. They are the main support of the churches, who are still foisting a patriarchal male god upon them. And this is so incongruous. They're women. Why on earth are they considering themselves servants of a male god?
Mm-hmm.
They should at least have a female figure to worship as well as a male one, or better than a male one. Remember, all children are atheists. And if religion is not inculcated into their minds, they would remain so. But they're certainly not immoralists. As soon as we figure out that we need to be kind to other people, if we expect them to be kind to us, we have a morality. And it has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with behavior and social codes. The codes that have been given us by religion are, by and large, abusive. And they threaten a hell. They promise pie in the sky or threats, and neither one of which seems to be anything but an illusion. So really, natural morality is far superior. The God of the Old Testament and even of the New Testament is very threatening. He has all kinds of horrific things that he's going to do to you if you don't obey.
Right. Now then, of course, there's Jesus, who... And some passages seems very much different than that.
Yeah, well, Jesus says you have to, well, he recommends that men castrate themselves if they want to be sure of getting into heaven. He says that you should renounce your whole family in order to follow him. He says that women are inferior. He condones slavery. There are lots of passages in the New Testament that don't sound very moral to me. And then, of course, my big question when I was a kid in Sunday school was, if God is all-powerful, why couldn't God just forgive everybody? Why does he have to make Jesus die? My feeling was that this is being a very, very bad father to your dearly beloved son.
Mm-hmm.
And it put me off right away, I mean, from the very beginning. What kind of a father is it that demands his son be tortured to death? Why would that be necessary? You know, it was a question that I absolutely rejected because it sounded so mean.
It is mean.
And then, of course, there was the attitude toward animals. Falling away from Christianity was when I was told, I was grieving for the death of a beloved dog, and I was told that I would not meet my dog in heaven because animals have no soul. And I was so upset by that. And I said I did not want to go to this heaven if there were no animals, no pets, if God did not allow us to have our beloved pets. God is just too mean. So I rejected heaven right then and there. I was like 6 years old. But that's another thing that has bothered me, you know, this feeling that we are different from, intrinsically different from and better than all the animals, which is absurd. I mean, obviously, we are part of the animal world like every other life form.
Yes.
And we need to recognize that.
Indeed. Well, that's kind of that story of your dog kind of set you on your path in a certain way, didn't it?
Yes, it certainly did. And I to this day, I resent having been told that my dog was forever lost to me. I said that he told me that I would meet all my relatives in heaven, and I said I would be willing to trade a couple of aunts and uncles for my dog if God would allow that. But, of course, God did not allow that, and and I was left forlorn.
What are your plans now? Getting this book out, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So you're doing readings and interviews?
Uh-huh, I am. And there's also the knitting thing. I get invited to a lot of knitting conferences now and again. Really take flyers along and let people distribute that.
Yes. Let me see. How did I find you? This is wonderful for people to look up as well, to see the pictures of you speaking at these wonderful little conferences and all women just really so appreciating who you are. It's really sweet to see.
Well, there are 4 treasuries of knitting patterns that I have done, and they are all used as source books by knitwear designers. If they just Google Barbara G. Walker, they get all kinds
they
of
do. That's right. That's yeah. Of course they do. Barbara, I want to thank you so much. I so appreciate your being here.
Thank you very much, Janie. It's my pleasure.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.